Hello everyone, it's July 2nd, 2024, and it's looking like Dream Chaser isn't going to make Vulcan's second flight. Luckily, Vulcan doesn't need the little space plane. It's going up anyway for DoD certification reasons. They just need something heavy to carry. Well, let's get the show in orbit. It doesn't weigh anything. And liftoff! And we've cleared the tower. Welcome to episode 466 of the Orbital Mechanics Podcast. I'm David.
I'm Ben.
And Dennis is out. He's recuperating from a party, I think. A housewarming party.
Yeah, housewarming. So he's going to show back up to do This Week in Spaceflight History, but he said, you know what? I think I need to go lay down. So we let him go recover. But SpaceX did a cool thing this week. This week, they launched their 1,000th Starlink. Not in total, their 1,000th Starlink of 2024. Actually, it wasn't this week. It was a little bit ago. It was in June. So they hadn't even hit the sixth month of the year, and they got 1,000 of these little plates up in orbit. Really insane.
And it was the sixth launch in just June, right? So I don't know if that's a record, six launches in
I don't think
one
it is.
Month. You don't think it is?
No, I think they're, their record is like 8 or 9. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Now that I'm thinking about it, they do like 2 a week. So, but yeah, 1,000.
The booster that did this mission was B1078. And this was the fifth time it had flown this year, like this calendar year since January. It's the 11th flight of the booster, but it's already flown 5 times this year. And like, it's so insane how quickly they turn these things around. This particular flight was 3.5 weeks. Turnaround time for the booster.
So I'm just imagining, like, if they could only do that with a second stage as well, they would have it in the can.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. Maybe Starship will do that.
I mean, I think it'd be cool to see a Falcon 9 first stage fly a whatchamacallit, Stokes Space upper stage.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I hope that thing works. It's so weird.
It's just such a cool idea.
It's kind of funny. I'm playing The Invincible right now. Actually, David, this is a video game. Sorry to bring up video game chat, but this is a video game that you might actually like. It's really just a interactive story. Like it's like a walking simulator is what this type of game is called. Mm-hmm. But it's retelling or depicting a story from a sci-fi book. And it all takes place on an alien planet, and the technology is very Soviet. And so it's kind of this cozy feeling tech that you're working with. But anyway, you see an orbital lander, like a shuttle, and really it looks like a capsule, like an Apollo capsule, that's, you know, a little bigger, a little taller. It's got landing legs and a door that opens and lets down a ramp. But now that I think about it, that's what Stokes lander or Stokes upper stage looks like. Is this lander from The Invincible.
The Vulcan train is leaving the station. What does that mean?
Yeah, in my notes I wrote toot toot all aboard. Unfortunately, the passenger's not on board. The train is leaving the station. The passenger is not. So let me rewind a little bit to give us some context before I talk about what this means. A few years ago, ULA built an inert payload to fly on their first Vulcan Centaur in case Peregrine, the lander, fell behind schedule. They really wanted to be able to fly their vehicle on time and get moving with their schedule. And so they said, okay, if Peregrine doesn't make it, we'll just fly a mass simulator. So on the second flight, called Certification 2, or Cert 2 is what they actually call it, they're supposed to fly Dream Chaser on its first demo flight to the space station. And Troy Bruno has said that, quote, "We have been informed by Sierra Space that they feel that they have significant risk towards making the mid-year flight date." And like, to be fair, Sierra Space, talking to Space News, said that they're making excellent progress and that they're on track to fly by the end of 2024, which is like fine, but it leaves Vulcan Centaur without a payload. So On June 26th, they announced that they are switching to that payload, and they're going to go ahead and fly this rocket for a second time. Or they're going to do like the normal launch and arrive at orbit. And then from there, they're actually going to do some additional activities to help characterize Centaur 5. Tori Bruno didn't really elaborate on what they're going to be doing or what characterization they're really looking for. The one thing he mentioned was looking at cryopropellant boil-off rates. But it sounds like they're probably going to be checking their reignition capability and maybe some communication stuff radiometric analysis, looking at the environment, the radio environment around the vehicle. But anyway, Space News was clear to point out that, yeah, they did check to see if there was another payload that could have flown here. And there just wasn't anything on their books that was going to work. So, yep, they have to switch to a non-paying customer. So when I was writing this up, I could hear you in the back of my head, David, saying, well, why do they need to fly it at all? And I think you already know the answer, but it seemed like a very David sort of question. And there's a really good answer. Basically, they need to qualify this vehicle, Vulcan Centaur, to DoD's satisfaction, because they have got at least two USSF flights scheduled, like booked and paid for. And so they need to qualify so that USSF is happy to let them fly their payloads so they can actually get that mission done. So the two vehicles that are scheduled are USSF 106 and 87. Both are scheduled to fly by the end of the year. And Tori Bruno says that they're pretty sure they're going to be able to fly by the end of the year. So that would be four flights in the first year for Vulcan. And to me, it seems kind of weird that Vulcan is like announced, it's in development, we're working on it. And then suddenly they're flying four flights in their very first year. Like, this thing is already ramping up to like fill the gaps from, you know, I guess retiring Atlas doesn't really... doesn't leave that much room because it didn't fly that often, but like, this thing is ready to go be a workhorse.
You said that one question I might ask is why would they need to fly it at all? But I think that it is pretty self-evident, like you said, because they have to qualify it. Now, if the question was, and I thought maybe you were wondering if I would ask why do they need to fly Dream Chaser, that might be a question, because you don't have to in order to qualify Vulcan itself, right? I mean, you need to qualify the vehicle in order to launch.
Evidently not, because they're switching it out for some dumbbells.
Right.
But obviously, it's better to pay to fly with a paying customer who's willing to take the risk than to fly with a bunch of steel.
Which maybe that was a question that I did ask. I don't remember if I did, but why Dream Chaser flying on this flight, I guess, I guess not now, but why did they want to do that, considering the risk?
Why was Dream Chaser happy to take the risk?
Yeah.
Because I don't think it's that much of a risk. It's more risk than Space Force is willing to take. But I mean, it's ULA, right? Like, if you were to ask why was... Peregrine happy to launch on the first flight, maybe that makes a little more sense. But even then, like, I don't think Peregrine was in any danger. But either way, you know, these are both commercial customers, not governments. And so maybe it just comes down to a cost risk assessment. Like, hey, we can fly for a little cheaper on one of these early flights and take a little more risk. And that just makes sense.
Yeah, I suppose if they're getting like maybe a reduction in the price, because I mean, it just seems surprising considering how long it took to develop and actually build Dream Chaser. And I don't know how many they're working on, right? Because there's obviously more than one. I think there's like, I mean, at least a couple, but this seems like it's been very labor intensive. And then they're just going to take one and put it on, you know, the first flight of something like this.
Yeah.
You know, it just seems kind of, you know, surprising.
So here's the cool thing. Is the issue wasn't so much building Vulcan. One of the big issues was the BE-4 engine. They just didn't have enough of them. And now Tori Bruno says that he's confident that production is ramping up or has ramped up. It's a little ambiguous, but that it's sufficiently ramped up and that they're not going to have to worry about getting enough engines. And to kind of flesh that statement out, Tori actually said that Vulcan is ahead of their need for next year. And so all they need is for the payloads to show up in time and they'll be able to fly. So yeah, they actually do have enough Vulcans ready to go that they're willing to burn one on a non-paying customer in order to get into those really high-paying customers like DOD.
Well, that wasn't what I was saying, but that's good to know. But I was talking about Dream Chaser. I mean, I was talking about, like, why risk Dream Chaser?
I mean, everything's a risk.
Yeah, well, sure, like, but
it's a balance.
It seems to me, I mean, I guess it does this, you know, this risk is worth it in this case, but it's not intuitive to me that it would be considering. I mean, if it was something like a Peregrine lander, maybe that doesn't seem as expensive. It didn't take as long maybe to build. I mean, but it seems like
certainly didn't take as long to build.
Yeah, so it just seems like Dream Chaser seems almost like it's not like, you know, as complex and big as something like Space Shuttle was, but for them, it seems like it was. Like, this really took quite a long time, and then they're just going to put one on a, you know, unproven rocket, you might say.
Yeah, I mean, you could totally call it unproven, even though it's flown once. But I think part of it might, I think that the risk is just low enough that it makes sense. But there might also be a component in getting onto a vehicle this big is not easy. And if, you know, if there's this flight that has slightly more risk and no other customers are really clamoring for it, like if you can get in to that schedule, you're going to get into it if you really need to fly your vehicle. And at this point, maybe Sierra is so, I don't want to invoke the sunk cost fallacy, but maybe they have spent so much time not getting any profit out of the Dream Chaser program that they just need to get it going. Like, obviously they wound up missing the deadline, but when they scheduled it originally, when they bought that rocket, maybe it was just worth it to get in and get on the schedule and get the program moving.
I'm sure that must be the case or something like that. So I was just looking up. Yeah. So they have three vehicles. That's how many Dream Chasers there are. I don't know if there's more that are slated to be built, but that's what they're working with. Yeah, it just seemed to me that this was particularly, yeah, this was a very difficult vehicle to both develop and then actually construct. So hopefully, yeah, you know, it all goes well.
Yeah, you would hate to lose it for sure. But I think the correct framing here is that USSF is extremely risk averse, rather than Dream Chaser and Peregrine are particularly risk accepting. I think that Space Force is the odd one out in the group of people building spaceships big enough to fly on Vulcan Centaur.
And, you know, if it was something like, and obviously this wouldn't be launched on a Vulcan, but if it was like a Crew Dragon, I wouldn't even blink an eye because I'm like, well, they can build more. They seem to be pretty good at that. I mean, that's something that you know, like SpaceX can do. It just seems that Dream Chaser took forever. And so that's just why it feels that way to me. Like, oh no, like, do you want to risk it? But obviously they're going to have to at some point because the whole point is to go into space. So
I wish I knew more about what has caused the Dream Chaser delays. I suspect that maybe it just hasn't been super well funded after they lost the CRS award.
I don't know either. It's probably a combination of funding, and then I remember there being some big problems with heat tiles, I think, for a while. I mean, who knows? Mm. I just can't.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Probably just lots of different issues, because I mean, it's a, you know, a little space plane thing. I mean, that's difficult. Capsules do seem easier. So this is actually kind of, I mean, this is a pretty impressive vehicle in many ways. It's a little mini space shuttle.
Yeah. So there are seven dragons. I had to go look it up because I was like, well, how many dragons actually are there? Like, they fly a lot, but they fly a lot, which means, okay. But actually there's seven of them. There are four crew dragons: Endeavor, Resilience, Endurance, and Freedom. And like, that was the number that I was thinking for all the dragons in my head. I was like, it's probably like four of them and they just fly over and over. But yeah, actually there's seven of them that are active. Five have been retired or destroyed in the case of the Demo 1 flight. You know, two of those or three of those are prototypes that are in testing, but like, you know, and then they've got one crew vehicle under construction. So yeah, I mean, like, you're right. They are very good at building these things. They got a fleet of seven.
So let's do three short and sweets this week. Ben, you have the first one.
Yeah, first up is Starliner's Extendedur ISS Day. Starliner's sometime in July return that we talked about last week now looks like a return, quote, before the end of July, as NASA begins ground testing at White Sands. They plan to put a thruster through a similar set of burns as Starliner's on approach to station and hope to replicate the deselect issue. Doing this while Starliner is still on orbit allows follow-up testing in space. While NASA is confident that the crew can return home safely, Ken Bowersox says that they are taking advantage of, quote, the luxury of time. Depending on how the debug sessions turn out, we may see a return after Starliner's 45-day limit because the crew module batteries have been performing better than expected.
Next up, a not-so-static test fire. Chinese commercial space company Space Pioneer experienced a mishap on Sunday when a test fire of the first stage of its Tianlong 3 rocket resulted in the stage escaping its hold down. Space Pioneer issued a statement saying there was a structural failure of the connection between the rocket body and the test bench, though the rocket's onboard computer automatically shut down the vehicle's 9 engines. In any event, the engines continued firing for at least 10 seconds after liftoff, and the vehicle caused an impressive explosion on impact 1.5 kilometers away from the pad. Luckily, there were no injuries reported.
And lastly, Resurs P1 breaks up. Just a few months from its projected re-entry, the retired Earth observation satellite Resurs P1 unexpectedly spewed over 180 pieces of debris. It is thought that the vehicle was insufficiently passivated, and either fuel or a battery was the cause, though a FOD strike by some untracked piece of debris might also have been responsible. Period. Done. Easy. Short. Sweet. Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's move on to This Week in Spaceflight History. We have three winners who all get the bonus points. We have Astro, Sci-Kyle, and Uncle Willy. And the clue was from rocket to lab. And I guess that this has nothing to do with Rocket Lab, and it doesn't. So what is this clue in reference to, Dennis?
So here I am making an in-orbit rendezvous with the podcast. So This Week in Spaceflight History is the 8th of July, 1994. And it was the launch of STS-65. This is a cool event. Like all shuttle missions, there's a lot going on. And when it comes to a lot going on, this one had a lot going on. But it was also, it was in particular a space lab mission. And so while, the wonderful podcast, The Space Above Us, likes to sometimes talk about these types of missions as, you know, there might not have been any kind of like really standout, exciting particular thing that happened, but that was kind of something that spoke a lot about how the program was doing a really good job in the 90s and how you could just send a mission up and get some good science done. And so this was definitely one of those where there weren't any, you know, particularly notable emergencies or, you know, it wasn't an abort to orbit. There weren't gold pins firing through nozzle bells. There wasn't anything like that. But it was still cool because I figured this might be a good opportunity to just talk about Space Lab more, because Space Lab itself is cool. And I don't think we talk enough about it. It's just, you know, a module that's sitting in the payload bay. But there's actually a lot of pretty cool, pretty neat things about it. And so just a little bit about the history of Space Lab, as well as where the clue comes from rocket to lab, is that I thought this might be a little bush league as a clue, but I'm glad we got some winners. Is that in the early days of the shuttle, like we're talking the 70s when it's still being planned, the European contribution kind of got boiled down to three possibilities. One was just sort of like general contributions to the shuttle. I don't know, parts of the airframe, you know, the orbiter itself. And that kind of pretty quickly got nixed. And then the other two options that were kind of floated, one was a space tug, and the other was what would ultimately was basically a module that could be carried around and used for different things. And so the space tug, which is the rocket part of the clue from rocket to lab, that ultimately got shot down because the U.S. wanted to just use our, you know, upper stages that we had, our PAMs and IUSs. And so those rockets, we're good. We didn't need to have the Europeans contribute a whole new one. But that module, which became Space Lab, was greenlit. And so that's why Space Labs are, they're a European contribution to the shuttle program. And so that's why you see a lot of times where, in particular, Germany was kind of the main nation behind Space Lab. And so Space Lab was really quite a few missions flew. And it had a combination of pressurized versus unpressurized modules, I guess. Yeah, I mean modules that were pressurized or pallets that were unpressurized. And you could have combinations of them. That's not something I realized. I knew that sometimes you had, like in some of the astronomy missions, you had a whole bunch of unpressurized pallets sitting out back. And you had the good old the igloo that would have the pressurized electronics that would control those, you know, pallets to whatever extent necessary. You'd never actually, like, people didn't go into the igloo. There was no tunnel connecting it or anything like that. But there was, of course, then the pressurized modules, but you could actually do combinations of them where you would have the pressurized module and then, you know, to the aft end behind that, further in the payload bay, you could have a pallet or two that would have some unpressurized experiments going on. And so and towards that end, there was actually a small viewport at the back of the space lab that you could have to go and view the pallet. But it was optional, just like there was also an overhead window and an overhead airlock that were also optional. So there was quite a lot of versatility that you could get from space lab. So, in any event, this STS-65 launch was a Columbia mission, and, you know, it was a good crew of seven. Just a couple standouts. Bob Cabana, who I'm sure you recognize that name from his post-astronaut career, where he has been the associate administrator of NASA in particular, more recently. And so he was the commander of that mission. This was his third space flight. And then we had a team where, even though it was, you know, Space Lab would often have European mission specialists or payload specialists on there, the only non-American that flew on this one was Chiaki Mukai, who was the payload specialist and the first Japanese woman to go to space. And so this was pre-JAXA, so she was, you know, a NASDA astronaut. But yeah, there's a lot of great images of her kind of floating around back in Space Lab. And so what type of Space Lab mission was this? Well, specifically, it was the IML-2, which stands for the International Microgravity Laboratory 2. Mission. So as you can imagine, IML-1 had already flown. And so the idea was to really kind of take advantage of what they call microgravity, what, you know, is really weightlessness. And there were over 80 experiments on board. So obviously doing an exhaustive rundown of them would not be helpful for anybody. But you can go and check that out. A lot of shuttle stuff is just so well documented. So if you do want to read about the newts and the jellyfish and Chiaki Mukai's own personal, you know, experiment that was, you know, growing some plant buds on orbit. You can go and read up on those. But there were no squirrel monkeys, I'm afraid. But there were a lot of other, like, little critters. And so, but not all of them were biological, though there were quite a few biological experiments. One of them was something we talked about on the show going back to Skylab, I believe. This one looked a bit different from what I remember it looking like during the Skylab days, but it was a lower body negative pressure device. And we talked actually, I think, originally about a modern version of that, that people were still, you know, still building. And so the idea is you kind of put this thing from the waist down and that goes and helps and kind of suctions your blood, I guess, more towards your feet as though you're in 1G. And so biologically, you can see why that might be helpful. But this, it looks like just a white cylinder. You know, I call it a sleeping bag, but it just is very much cylinder shaped. And so it kind of has a funny look to it, but in any event. So that was the whole idea here. You know, you get these, experiments on board. Obviously, this is the, you know, mid-90s, so this is pre-station by quite a bit. But so this was just a free-flying, you know, Columbia taking Space Lab to orbit. They didn't have to really do any of the kind of more wild stuff. It sounded like it was a pretty straightforward loading on the pad because this is, you know, a vertical payload that's installed vertically using the payload checkout room or changeout room, which is the giant clean room on the rotating part of the pad, the rotating service structure. Other missions I hadn't realized when I was researching this, involved things where, like, at the last minute, they had to go and rebuild an experiment that was in Space Lab while it was still in the PCR. And another time, they had to actually load hydrazine into one of the experiments. I'm assuming that was one of these pallet ones, especially if they're going to be in the PCR. But evidently, this keeping the PCR a clean room clean was a challenge during some of these other Space Lab missions. One time, there was an issue where they were basically trying to blast... clean the corrosion elsewhere on the pad and accidentally went and blew a whole bunch of just, I guess, corroded dust all over the clean room. And so it took weeks to go and clean that out again. And so this evidently was an uphill battle. And also apparently a lot of the science PIs that would go into this, you know, clean room, which is multiple stories high, looks like it's like, I don't know, five stories at least. And, you know, one of them, apparently there's a story about one PI that, you know, was taken there to look at their experiment right before it flew to space, and they froze in place once they stepped out of the elevator that they're at the 135-foot level. And so, yeah. I guess the most notable story that I encountered on this that I thought was pretty fun was that while they were up there, the Japanese scientists weren't getting the data that they expected from one of their experiments. And so Tracy Gill, who's an electrical engineer on the, you know, the Space Lab team, basically knew that that particular experiment was connected to cables that needed to be repaired before the mission. And so, you know, her quick, you know, troubleshooting mind was like, all right, well, just, you know, try wiggling the cable bundle. That should probably work. It probably has to do with, you know, just the fact that, you know, we had to repair it and maybe the repair wasn't 100%, but if you wiggle it, maybe that'll fix the connectivity. But apparently, JSC was like, we're not going to just tell them to go and wiggle the cable bundle. We want a full troubleshooting report and procedure if we're going to go and tell these astronauts who, right, every second that they're up there is, you know, precious time. And so they wanted to have a full report that they could go and give the astronauts. And so, you know, there was kind of like a rolling their eyes, but they went and wrote up this whole procedure. But evidently, before, you know, it was given to the astronauts, the crew on board, somebody had gone and inadvertently fixed it because someone, it wasn't specified who, but basically just happened to open the panel, I think it was underneath Space Lab, where those cables were, and they tried to read something that was written along the cables. And that meant that they grabbed and kind of moved the cables a little bit in that process. And as a result, ended up fixing it. So it was inadvertent wiggling, evidently. And so once they heard that, they were just like, yeah, no, just forget the procedure. Just close that panel and proceed as normal. And so everything worked out well there. But yeah, it was, you know, it was an uneventful 14-day mission. They got, you know, a ton of science done. And they flew and landed without incident. And so, again, to kind of echo the space above us, sometimes these missions that don't have these kind of big, wild, you know, memorable things kind of just show what it's like when the program's running smoothly and you're actually getting a lot of value and worth from your mission, from the science that the astronauts are doing on board. After these experiments, of course, are designed by people on the ground. And so, in any event, that was this week in spaceflight history. Nice little space lab flight.
Thank you, Dennis. Next week is the 9th to the 15th of July. David, do you have a clue for us?
I do. So the clue will be for next week in 2001, spiraling into control.
I love this clue. If you have a guess as to what it is referencing, email us at info@theorbitalmechanics.com. Shoot us a tweet on Mastodon, use the hashtag ThisWeekSF, or you can visit theorbitalmechanics.com/Discord for an invite to our Discord server. Good luck, everybody.
Good luck. All right, so let's move on to upcoming spaceflight events. And thank you to Launch Library 2, which is where we start our research each week. We have, I think, 6 different events, most of them launches. What's the first launch, Ben?
Yeah, shocker. It's a Starlink. So this is Falcon 9 Block 5 launching Starlink Group 8-9. That's going to be out of Cape Canaveral at Slick 40. This launch is taking place on Wednesday, July 3rd, between 0601 hours UTC and 1031 hours UTC.
Then after that, on July 4th, we have the launch of a Long March 6A. No real details on that one, so not much to say. Details are TBD, but it is launching from the Taiyuan Satellite Launch Center from Launch Complex 9A, and the window for that is... 2241 UTC through 2333 UTC. So, yep, that's happening.
And of course, this is based on NOTAM, so we're guessing on which pad it's flying from. And this is not the actual launch window. It's just the don't fly here launch.
Yeah.
Don't fly here window.
Yeah.
All right. After that, we have an event on NASA TV. So this is the CHIPIA Mission 1 egress event. So CHIPIA is a, might be CHAPIA. I'm going to say CHIPIA is a Mars simulator where, you know, basically they got a bunch of people under a dome pretending to be on Mars, and they're going to be coming out on Saturday, July 6th at 5 p.m. is when the event starts. So you can watch that on NASA TV.
And then after that, on July 8th, we have the launch of a Falcon 9 Block 5, and that is launching TurkSat 6A, a geostationary communication satellite, the first domestically manufactured one, apparently, by Turkey. That is launching from Cape Canaveral from Slick 40, and the liftoff time for that is 2120 UTC. So that looks to be an instantaneous launch window, or an instantaneous launch time, right? I guess it's not really a window. Anyway, that's when it's lifting off.
After that, we have, yay, Ariane 6's first flight. So this is called an Ariane 62 or an Ariane 6-2. That's the configuration. There are two different configurations. 6-2 has got two of the solid boosters. 6-4 has got, yeah, you guessed it, four of the solid boosters. So this is a big rideshare payload going to, I guess, a reasonably low inclination LEO. There are a bunch of different universities that have small satellites on board, but so does NASA, which is pretty neat. So that's going to be flying out of French Guiana, Ariane Launch Area 4, on Tuesday, July 9th, between 1800 hours UTC and 2100 hours UTC.
And then after that, we have Transporter 11 launching on a Falcon 9 Block 5. So this is, yeah, a rideshare going to Sun's synchronous orbit. Don't know the exact liftoff time, but yeah, the speculative window, I think is how you put it, Ben, is between 1730 or 0530 the next day UTC. So we don't really know, but that's when it might lift off. And yeah, that's launching from Vandenberg Space Force Base from Space Launch Complex 4E on July 10th.
All right. Those are your upcoming space flight events.
All right. Which means it's time to adjourn with the show. And we would like to thank Ron Jenkins and Tim Dodd for our music.
For more information on this episode, such as show notes and other links, visit our website at theorbitmechanics.com.
And we record live on Sundays at 9 a.m. p.m. and 12 p.m. Eastern. And thank you so much to Mike, Colin, Delta V, and Mr. Steeson for joining our recording session today and helping us make correction burns on the fly.
If you want to support the show, please leave us a review wherever you listen, or better yet, tell a friend. You can also visit theorbitalmechanics.com/support for our Patreon campaign and affiliate links.
And get in touch. Find links to our mailing list, Discord server, and Mastodon account at theorbitalmechanics.com/about, or you can skip all that by emailing info@theorbitalmechanics.com. So that's it. We'll see you all next week on Orbit. Until then, later.
Bye, everybody.